to more than $100 million. Steve's eyes grew really big. He appreciated a masterful product launch, and his own introductions paled against this one. That's when he got serious about cooking up an audacious plan for an initial public offering of Pixar stock. His goal was to raise enough money for the company to fund its own movie productions, thus enabling it to become a full partner to Disney rather than a mere contractor. Making the decision about the details for an IPO, of course, was a task for Steve to handle rather than Catmull or Lasseter. He recently had hired a new CFO by the name of Lawrence Levy, a sharp Silicon Valley attorney with a background in patent law. Right away, he and Levy spent weeks studying the ins and outs of film finance and accounting to get a better sense of how studios really make their money. As part of their homework, they flew down to Hollywood to quiz other executives at other studios about movie budgets and distribution deals. They immediately learned that Pixar was, at least at that point, a long shot for a successful IPO. Its financial performance to date was pretty dismal. It had accumulated losses of $50 million over the years, while generating little revenue. Its potential revenue stream seemed limited and risky. Pixar was largely dependent on one company, Disney, which was the sole licensee of Cap's technology and which would return to Pixar a mere 12.5% of box office revenues of any movies they might make and market together. Moreover, Pixar seemed to move at a snail's pace, having already spent nearly 4 years on a movie that still wasn't finished. The movie business itself was notoriously unpredictable. And finally, the company relied on the creative ideas of a very few people, like Lasseter and Stanton, who had good reputations but no significant track record. Steve had his own misgivings about Toy Story's commercial potential, mainly based upon what he was hearing from Disney's marketers. "Disney came to do a big presentation to us about the marketing," remembers Lasseter. "They told us they had a big promotional plan with Sears." Steve looks around the room and goes, "Has anybody in this room been into a Sears lately? Anybody?" No one raises a hand. "Then why are we making a deal with Sears? Why are we not going for products we like? Can't we be doing a deal with Rolex? Sony high-end audio equipment?" And their answer was basically, this is what we do." He poked holes in every one of their ideas. He was just so logical. "Why associate ourselves with products we can't stand?" In the end, the most prominent sponsor would turn out to be Burger King. As long as Pixar had not filed with the SEC for an IPO, Steve was free to do what he could to drum up excitement about Pixar in the business press. Still, I was surprised one Saturday morning in May when the phone rang in my home and it was Steve. He asked if I wanted to come over, but this time with Greta and Fernanda, my two daughters, who were then just 10 and 9 years old. "I'm watching Reed this morning," he told me, "and I've got something cool to show them." When we arrived, 3-year-old Reed Jobs greeted us at the kitchen door, wrapped in blue and red silk scarves, and screeching, "I'm a witch!" Reed fluttered around while Steve got the kids some juice and made bowls of popcorn. Then he and I followed the three kids into the den, where Steve popped a VHS cassette into the player. After a bunch of crude storyboards, all of a sudden a full-color early version of Toy Story burst onto the screen, and a soundtrack kicked in. I had seen storyboards lining the walls at Pixar, but no actual animation at that point. It was truly spectacular, and completely unlike anything I'd seen on a screen before. The three kids sat wrapped on the floor in front of the TV. They watched the whole thing, even though only about half of it was fully completed, with the rest filled in by line drawings or semi-complete renderings. When it was over, Steve told me that the Pixar board of directors hadn't even seen this much of the movie. I took that with a grain of salt. Lasseter later told me that Steve showed it to everyone. "He was impossible." Steve's friend Larry Ellison, the billionaire founder of Oracle, said he saw 11 different versions. Steve quickly turned from me to the kids. He was busy conducting market research, Steve Jobs style. "What do you think?" he asked the girls. "Is it as good as Pocahontas?" Greta and Fernanda nodded vigorously. "Well, then is it as good as The Lion King?" Fernanda pondered for a beat, then replied, "I won't be able to make up my mind until I see Toy Story 5 or 6 more times." Steve loved the answer. On August 9th, Steve got lucky again when a little company called Netscape Communications went public. Netscape's product, the first popular internet browser, was a revolutionary thing, but there was no obvious way for the company to turn it into a big moneymaker. No matter, the public's enthusiasm for technology and this new darling called the internet was about to soar. Netscape shares were offered at $28 and closed the day at $58.25, giving the new company a valuation of $2.9 billion. After Netscape's IPO, Pixar didn't seem quite so wispy a bet. Robertson Stevens, a San Francisco investment bank, agreed to underwrite the IPO and filed a prospectus with the SEC in October. Steve decided to push his luck even further and set the date for Pixar's IPO on November 29, 1995, merely 1 week after Toy Story's debut. If the movie had flopped, the IPO would have been a disaster, and all Steve's efforts to get Pixar onto more secure financial footing would have been for naught. But of course, that's not what happened. The movie is a masterpiece, a soulful, funny film of such enduring power that the American Film Institute includes it in its list of the 100 greatest American movies. And Pixar's IPO the following week was a blockbuster as well, raising $132 million and giving the company a market capitalization of $1.4 billion. Lasseter, Catmull, Steve, and other Pixarians gathered to follow the affair from Robertson Stevens's offices in downtown San Francisco. Shortly after the opening bell, when the stock was trading above the $22 per share price that the bank had established, Catmull saw Steve pick up the phone in an office to the side. "Hello, Larry?" Steve said into the handset once his pal Ellison was on the line. "I made it." Steve, who owned 80% of the company, was a billionaire. While Steve did enjoy comparing notes and playing games with Ellison, who at the time was one of the very richest men in the world and still is, money wasn't what thrilled Steve about Pixar. What thrilled him was to once again play a part in the creation of a successful and profoundly beautiful product that employed brilliant new technology that had seemingly unlimited potential. He loved that once again he was an architect of what the world could not help but recognize as a remarkably creative enterprise. Steve hadn't felt that way for what had seemed like eons. Not since the introduction of the Macintosh 11 years earlier. The incredible success of Toy Story and of Pixar in general had a huge personal significance for Steve as well. He always wanted to make products that he both loved and found useful. That's part of the reason that things never seemed quite so magical at Next. Unlike Bill Gates, Steve couldn't throw himself completely into the creation of a product that suited a particular market, but that didn't thrill him personally. The Next computer and the subsequent software products were admirable and elegantly beautiful in their own ways. But they were aimed at institutions rather than people. With Toy Story, for the first time in his life, he had a hand in the creation of a product that a young family like his own could enjoy as well. Loreen was pregnant with daughter Erin, the second of their 3 children. Steve reveled in the fact that Toy Story was something that his kids could enjoy, and even their kids as well. In retrospect, the fact that Toy Story was the beginning of Steve's professional resurrection seems preposterously appropriate. Its plot established the Pixar formula. A likable character is the cause of his own downfall, often as a result of hubris. But he, or she, once Pixar finally made brave, overcomes weakness through kindness, bravery, quick wits, invention, or some combination thereof, and thereby earns a redemption that makes him, or her, an even better and more complete toy, or bug, car, fish, princess, monster, robot, mouse, or superhero. The hero's downfall, incidentally, often involves some kind of exile, as in Toy Story, where Woody accidentally sends Buzz careening into Sid's backyard, and then must join him to engineer a hair-raising escape from that evil child. The parallels to Steve's own exile from Apple are obvious. Toy Story also gave Steve back his confidence. He and I spoke several times in the months after the IPO, and I could tell he was beyond ecstatic about the way things had gone. He talked about what had happened at Pixar, and about his role in its success, with real pride. He was generous in giving large stock grants to Catmull and Lasseter, and he personally handed out bonus paychecks of an extra month's pay to all Pixar employees in December. Sure, some of them grumbled that they hadn't received higher stock grants, and sure, Steve claimed more credit for Pixar's sudden success than he deserved. But even Alvy Ray Smith, the original partner of Catmull, who had left after clashing with Steve, later admitted that Pixar could not have succeeded without him. "We should have failed," Alvy told one interviewer. But it seemed to me that Steve just would not suffer another defeat. He couldn't sustain it. As happy as Steve was, however, to bask in the glory of Pixar's success, he quickly moved on. He had another motive for engaging me in all those post-IPO conversations. He was starting to think about his old company down in Cupertino. Chapter 8. Bozos, Bastards, and Keepers. Thanks to the unlikely, dizzying success of Toy Story and the Pixar IPO, Steve was back in the limelight. He got more than his fair share of the attention, but neither Ed Catmull nor John Lasseter cared too much about that. Now that Pixar was on solid financial footing, they were both ecstatic to be developing their next movie, A Bug's Life, without having to worry about the fate of their company. To the outside world, it seemed that Jobs had rediscovered his pixie dust. The success of Toy Story had given the myth of Steve Jobs a rather nice touch-up. The question now was whether Steve's Pixar triumph was a one-shot anomaly. For a man whose name eventually would become synonymous with great American second acts, the Steve Jobs of 1996 had had remarkably little success with his own sequels. The Apple II had been followed by the Apple III and the Lisa, both of which had been failures. The Mac became a success only in the more robust versions introduced by John Sculley. His most grandiose sequel of all, Next, the company he'd created to be an idealized version of Apple, had proved utterly anticlimactic. Pixar had provided some redemption. But Steve, of course, had been on top of the world before. The question was whether he'd handled it any better than he had in the past. Would he repeat the same mistakes? Or, to put it in the language of Pixar, would he make like Woody in Toy Story and take to heart what he learned in exile? Could he temper his ego, play well with others, defeat his enemies, and emerge a true hero? The last 4 years of Next, following the demise of the IBM deal in 1992, were something of a tragicomedy. Steve tried so many different strategies that the company meandered without direction. He created a cheaper, pizza box-shaped computer called the Next Station, but it never gained any traction. He and his team decided to design another model, based on a new microprocessor called the PowerPC chip, the same one that Apple's newer Macs would be using. But eventually, they decided there was no real market for the machine. Not a single one was ever manufactured. Mike Slade, who was head of marketing for a time, would occasionally think fondly of his old employer, Microsoft, which was like the Yankees, he remembers. Going to work for Next was like being a starting pitcher on the 1998 Florida Marlins, A team that won, like, what, 50 games? In those days, Steve was kind of a forgotten guy. He was like Brian Wilson after he had walked out on the Beach Boys, someone who had faded, a has-been. He became a pretty irrelevant guy in the high-tech world. Steve was in the wrong business now. He was put on this earth to sell to consumers, not corporate IT managers. Steve had great marketing instincts, but they were wasted at a company that had not created a competitive product. One day he told Slade that he wanted to pick a fight with Sun. So he had Slade ask two programmers to create a fairly basic database application. One using a Next computer armed with the company's software, the other using a Sun workstation and Solaris, Sun's implementation of Unix. Slade had their work videotaped. The Next programmer completed his task so much earlier than his counterpart on the Sun workstation that he had time to play a bunch of computer games. The video that they eventually released showed the Sun programmer muttering, as time ran out, I've just got a couple more things to work on. Next followed up with 8 spread advertisements in the Wall Street Journal, spending the company's entire marketing budget for that year in one swoop. The result? A shitstorm of publicity, just as Steve had predicted. Slade recalls, with a suppressed guffaw. Sun's Scott McNeely went public, whining about Next's immature marketing. What people didn't understand, says Slade, is that Steve could be just as brilliant when he had to think small. I came up with this elaborate marketing strategy, and he said, nope, the only thing that counts is picking a fight. And he was right. If he was brilliant at moments, he was still confounded by the ins and outs of running the company. His series of managerial miscues reached its climax when he hired a garrulous Brit named Peter van Kylenberg to run the company's day-to-day operations. The tale of PVC, as he was called, speaks to how unfocused Steve could be. Having impulsively decided that he really had to hire a president, Steve ran through a series of barely vetted candidates before turning to van Kylenberg, a veteran of Xerox and Texas Instruments, who had rejected by fax a previous job offer. Steve professed adoration. If I was about to get run over at a crosswalk, he told the New York Times, I would feel good about leaving Peter in charge of Next. Eventually, it was van Kylenberg who got run over, figuratively speaking. He had promised to give Next a clear strategy, but that's not what happened. Zeroing in on details, van Kylenberg found resistance from some employees who felt he was more interested in process than products. Worse yet, he and Steve seemed to often be at odds. Investors like Canon, that had invested $100 million in 1989, would complain that they didn't know who was running the company, Steve or van Kylenberg. The staff, too, got mixed signals. At least a couple of top executives believed van Kylenberg tried to sell the company to Sun Microsystems without telling Steve. Van Kylenberg denies this, and Sun's CEO at the time, Scott McNeely, denies that the two companies ever came close to a deal. But there's no doubt that the two did not make a successful management team. PVC was not at Next for long. Shortly after he left, Steve, the ultimate hardware guy, made the painful decision to end production of the Next computer. The physical design of computers engaged him more than anything else, and he took great pride in the beauty and functionality of the machines he oversaw. But the sleek Next computers weren't selling. Steve reluctantly shut down the hardware division, fired half the staff, and shunted the remaining hardware and factory assets off to Canon in a deal overseen by John Rubinstein. The Fremont factory building itself was put on the market to be leased out or sold as what it had been before, basic warehouse space. The original dream, that Next would create the world's next great computer, was over. We got lost in the technology, Steve would later tell me. There was no hiding Next's failure, and there was no hiding the fact that Next's failure was primarily Steve's doing. This was the low point of Steve's career. He was distraught over having failed, and, uncharacteristically, he let his disappointment show. One day, Ed Catmull read a Next press release about, he says, how Next is really happy to be selling software to control government information servers, or data centers, or something mundane like that. I read this and thought, oh shoot, this has got to be killing Steve. So I called him up. We met at a Japanese restaurant in Palo Alto, and I said, this isn't you, Steve. And he went, oh, I know, I hate this so much. I mean, CIOs are nice guys, but God, is this awful. In public, Steve tried to portray this shift as a bold bet on the company's software, especially its Next Step operating system, which had, he said, no competitors. At this time, his sophistry was recognized as such by the media and by those competitors like Microsoft, who supposedly did not exist. Steve did not shut down the entire company. Just as he had never given up on Pixar, he never quite gave up on Next. And just as he had at Pixar, he decided to play out two separate end strategies. He half-heartedly pitched the company to Sun again, Hewlett-Packard, and even Larry Ellison's Oracle. But nothing ever came through. At the same time, he kept pushing Avi Tavanian and his software team hard. Steve genuinely believed he had the sharpest team of operating system software engineers in the business, and he still hoped that the workstation world might embrace the Next Step operating system. So the software engineers kept beating the bugs out of it and porting it to other microprocessor architectures, such as Intel's Pentium family or the PowerPC chip from IBM and Motorola. Steve worried deeply about finding a way to repay his investors, who had provided nearly $350 million in working capital. Not making them whole would have mortally wounded his credibility as an entrepreneur if he ever tried to start another computer company. So Steve waited to see where Next Step and Avi's crack team of engineers would lead him. By 1996, it began to seem as if their efforts might pay off in at least a modest way. Avi's team had developed another software product that was drawing accolades. WebObjects was a tool for building commercial websites and other online applications out of modules of pre-built code, called objects, that sped the development process and allowed the reuse of standardized components. This capability was especially helpful in building online stores, and the World Wide Web was now teeming with independent software developers and corporate coders building interactive websites with a commercial component. Business had grown so quickly that sales of WebObjects licenses now generated more revenue than Next Step. Finally, Next could truly say it was generating a small operating profit. Steve even lined up Merrill Lynch to back a potential IPO. Once again, a company of Steve's had found its footing by transforming into something other than what he had intended. Around that time, on April Fool's Day, 1996 to be precise, a former Air Force captain named Fred Anderson showed up at Apple Computer Headquarters at One Infinite Loop in Cupertino for his first day of work as the chief financial officer. What he found there was a disaster. It was a house on fire, he remembers. Anderson, who was then 52 years old, had held a similar position at a computer services company called ADP, based in Roseland, New Jersey. ADP was a well-oiled machine, but its business, providing data management services to other large corporations, was about as prosaic as they come in the world of high tech. Anderson had been there 4 years and had already fixed whatever needed his special skills and attention. He was bored, yet he and his wife Marilyn had spent years renovating and expanding their traditional Tudor home in Essex Falls, New Jersey, and he was just getting settled into the suburban life of a typical East Coast corporate big shot. He wasn't looking for a new job. But then an executive search firm for Apple Computer came calling. The Cupertino company began aggressively wooing him shortly after CEO Michael Spindler abruptly fired the company's previous CFO in November 1995. Apple Computer had always meant something special to Anderson and his wife. Judging from his appearance, you wouldn't suspect that Fred Anderson was what people now would call an Apple fanboy. He looked the part of a wonky corporate CFO. Tall, even-tempered, well-coiffed and partial to dress slacks, and crisply pressed monogrammed shirts, or, when slumming it, to khakis and a polo shirt. But both he and his wife were avid Macintosh users, and had always felt a special, almost romantic affection for the company since its very founding. Fred originally hailed from Southern California, and Marilyn had graduated from Stanford University, smack dab in the middle of Silicon Valley. They had always hankered to move back to the West Coast. So Anderson listened to what Apple had to say. As with all things Apple at the time, his recruitment had its own drama. Company officials didn't bother to tell Anderson that, even as they were pursuing him, the company was secretly trying to hammer out a merger with Sun Microsystems. Anderson probably should have sensed that something was not right when one of his early phone conversations with Spindler, a gruff German nicknamed the Diesel, came while the executive was convalescing in the hospital for a health condition brought on by extreme stress. Spindler would be fired in the weeks ahead, after which Anderson found himself being courted as the first big hire of Apple's next CEO, Gil Amelio, a former semiconductor executive who had been a member of the Apple Board of Directors for less than a year. Ultimately, it wasn't the sales pitch from Spindler or Amelio that swayed him. It was more as if Anderson sold himself on the Apple job, using the same logic Steve Jobs had used on John Sculley when wooing him with that famous taunt. Do you want to spend the rest of your life selling sugared water, or do you want a chance to change the world? Anderson liked the idea that he might help save a great American success story from oblivion. There was a part of me that said, you know, I'd hate to see that company die, he remembers. That's reason number one. I knew how passionate my wife and I were about their products, and I believe that there was this loyal, passionate customer base that didn't want Apple to die. What I hoped was that it also translated into a passionate employee base that would fight to save the company, too. But to be honest, I didn't know that for sure. When I told my wife I'd like to take the Apple job, she looked at me and said, "Are you crazy? You already have a fantastic job." Apple's troubles were deep indeed, and had worsened over many years. John Sculley's market-driven strategy failed to produce any significant technological breakthroughs. Apple's efforts to do so were only made worse by the CEO's desire to prove himself to be as much of an innovator as Steve. Most costly of all his misguided efforts was his attempt to carve out a brand new category of personal computing with a handheld device called the Newton, which was met with widespread ridicule after its highly touted handwriting recognition feature turned out to be prone to absurd malapropisms. It was an expensive failure, made worse by the fact that Sculley decided to open a bunch of Apple retail stores to sell the doomed new device. Sculley's nurturing of the Macintosh did provide some financial cover for the company. But Apple's share of the PC market eroded as Windows steadily improved. The Apple board grew disenchanted with Sculley's misfires and abruptly dismissed him in 1993. They replaced him with Spindler, the German sales executive whose idea of a strategy was for Apple to ape Bill Gates and license the Macintosh operating system to other manufacturers in a belated attempt to fend off Windows. But this strategy too failed, and the availability of cheap clones tarnished Apple's mystique as a maker of premium hardware. Spindler, who preserved Sculley's old market-driven approach to product development, also allowed Apple's product line to swell uncontrollably as engineers experimented with different bells and whistles in order to target potential markets that they thought warranted entirely new and distinct Macintosh models. But Apple's biggest problem was Microsoft. Bill Gates's company had become a juggernaut, and with the release of Microsoft's Windows 95, it formally seized the initiative for driving PC innovation from Apple. It even outdid Apple in over-the-top marketing. Gates introduced this landmark version of his industry-standard operating system with a tightly orchestrated, worldwide rollout emceed by Jay Leno from a big white circus tent on the Microsoft campus and beamed by satellite to gatherings in 43 cities around the world. The fanfare prompted tens of millions of PC users to line up for hours or even days in order to be among the first to be able to buy the software and install it on their machines when it went on sale at midnight on August 24th. The Rolling Stones' Start Me Up was the official promotional anthem. Apple's own attempts over the previous 8 years to modernize the architecture of its computer operating system had failed again and again. Projects with code names like Pink, Gershwin, and Copeland fell by the wayside, and a couple of awkward joint ventures also went nowhere, including one with IBM curiously named Patriot Partners. The problem was that there were so many things Windows 95 could do that Apple's aging Macintosh System 7 simply couldn't begin to match. The list included nerdy-sounding features like preemptive multitasking, which allowed several applications to operate simultaneously without interfering with one another, automatic document saving, and most important, much greater speed, stability, and reliability. Microsoft went so far as to hire the graphic designer for the original Macintosh on-screen icons to spiff up Windows' look and feel. Windows 95 also introduced the Start button, which made it much easier for users to deduce how to launch programs and otherwise manage files in a PC. Overnight, Apple's sales tanked, and inventories of unsold Apple machines and unused components began to pile up. Worse, Apple seemed to have instantly and visibly lost whatever mojo it was that had made it seem cool for nearly two decades. After Windows 95, Apple wouldn't post consecutive years of sales growth again until 2002. By the time Spindler was bounced in the spring of 1996 and replaced by Emilio, Apple had become an undisciplined and unmitigated mess, in just about every way imaginable, with sales shriveling at a truly alarming rate. No longer a growth company, the cash-strapped outfit was beginning to hemorrhage money. It had far more manufacturing capacity, inventory, and, of course, employees than it needed or could afford. There were no promising new products in the pipeline, much less over the horizon. No wonder Spindler had been so stressed out, and no wonder he was fired. No wonder Emilio and longtime Apple director Mike Markkula immediately redoubled their efforts to find a buyer, like Sun Microsystems or the old AT&T, or even IBM. No wonder they had to consider filing for bankruptcy. No wonder they needed a great CFO. Anderson gave his notice to ADP in March and spent a month consulting for Apple before he and his wife moved west. He knew the situation was getting desperate, but it wasn't until he arrived at corporate headquarters that he began to get a sense of just how bad things were in Cupertino. Nothing in his career had prepared him for anything quite like this. ADP had posted 35 consecutive years of double-digit earnings. His employer before that, a mini-computer maker called MAI Basic 4, had been through some rough patches, but nothing comparable to Apple's quagmire. In the previous 6 months, Apple had swooned from being marginally profitable to posting a loss of nearly three-quarters of $1 billion in the first calendar quarter of 1996. The company soon would be technically in default on hundreds of millions of dollars of bank loans. On his very first day at Apple, Anderson was shocked to learn that Emilio had already asked bankruptcy counsel to stand by. What Fortune 500 CFO in his right mind would want to step into this mess? Steve observed Apple's dire straits from a safe distance, fretting and muttering under his breath, and off the record like an embittered and estranged parent, that the famous company he co-founded might collapse of its own ineptitude. After 10 years in exile, he still harbored a strong sense of attachment to his firstborn company and many of its employees. "He loved Apple," says John Lasseter. "I mean, he loved Apple the whole time. It was painful for him to watch what was happening to it." Indeed, the reason Steve had held on to one share of Apple stock for the previous decade was to be able to keep getting shareholder information materials and, if the spirit moved him, to be able to attend the annual shareholders' meeting. He hadn't cut the cord completely. In 1995, his billionaire friend Larry Ellison had suggested the idea of making a hostile bid to buy the company outright, so they could take it private and run it as they saw fit. Ellison had even offered to raise the bulk of the money, so Steve wouldn't have to risk his own resources. Pixar hadn't yet gone public. "Steve's the only one who can save Apple," he told me. "We've talked about it very seriously many, many times, and I'm ready to help him the minute he says the word. I could raise the money in a week." But Steve had nixed the effort. Despite the allure of Apple, he had made a pragmatic decision. He was in the middle of Pixar's most critical year when it released Toy Story and went public. He was trying to salvage Next, and Loreen was pregnant with their second child. It had all seemed like too much. In retrospect, deflecting Ellison's offer was the first of a series of practical, well-considered, and mature decisions that Steve would make on the road back to Apple. Opportunism, intuition, and manipulation would all come to play a role in his return to the company he loved most. But by also employing a newfound patience and maturity, Steve would return a better businessman. Fred Anderson's first official duty was to announce that Apple had lost $750 million in the quarter that had ended the day before he arrived. He had indeed walked right into a house on fire. The grisly loss triggered bank agreement covenants that called on Apple to immediately pay back some debt. But if Apple did so, the company would quickly find itself in what is euphemistically called a liquidity crisis. In plain English, Apple would not have enough cash on hand or in the bank to make those required payments and to pay its other bills and employee salaries. So Anderson knew he would have to move quickly to persuade Apple's banks in the United States, Japan, and Europe to forgo calling their loans for a time. Then he would have to get cracking to accomplish two things that might keep the banks at bay: work out a recapitalization plan to raise more money in the public bond markets, and set in place a restructuring plan that would drastically reduce the company's operating expenses. The word restructuring is a euphemism, of course. The very best way to reduce expenses in a hurry is to lay off employees. Lots and lots of employees. Before April was out, Anderson had personally visited all of Apple's major bank lenders to ask for leniency and to present his intentions for restructuring and recapitalization. He also went to Apple's lead investment bankers, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and Deutsche Bank, to put together plans for a commercial paper offering designed to raise $661 million, which the company would use in part to pay its bank lenders and to help fund ongoing operations. It was basically yet another loan, this time from investors, and at a somewhat higher rate of interest. But it bought Apple time to put its house in order and to trim its headcount. The goal of the restructuring was to eventually eliminate fully half of its 11,000 full-time employees, so that the company would be able to break even with sales of around $5.5 billion, or half of its annual sales in 1985. In other words, Anderson believed that half of the company would have to disappear before things would bottom out. The layoffs would come in three waves over the next 2 years. The restructuring and recapitalization plan bought CEO Gil Amelio more time and flexibility to find a way to address Apple's other big problem: its technological stasis. He needed to go shopping for an existing advanced operating system that Apple could adapt to the Macintosh to help it keep pace with Microsoft's new improved Windows 95. Doing so would be an open admission of Apple's inability to create competitive technology on its own. But at least it would offer a glimmer of hope The company had other options than a merger or bankruptcy. To find a shortcut to developing a more advanced version of the Macintosh OS, Emilio looked for companies that had built a working version of Unix that ran on familiar microprocessors. Sun and several other companies, including IBM, Apollo, by now part of Digital Equipment Corporation, Next, and an obscure Silicon Valley startup called B Incorporated, all had developed their own implementations of BSD Unix. A version developed by Sun co-founder Bill Joy, and had managed to port them to machines employing chips from the very same family of microprocessors that Apple used in its Lisa and Macintosh. The pure software companies were most interesting because they were cheap enough to buy outright and small enough to absorb. Next was one possibility, but because it was run by Steve Jobs, a man many on the Apple board still considered to be persona non grata, that didn't seem a likely match. But B Incorporated seemed like an intriguing possibility. That's because B was headed by Jean-Louis Gasset, the former head of advanced product development for Apple, who had left in late 1990 after clashing with Scully. Jean-Louis Gasset was the Apple sales and marketing guy who had warned John Scully that Steve was planning to challenge his authority in the spring of 1985, prompting the CEO to cancel his trip to China and impose a corporate reorganization that all but marginalized the young co-founder. That sealed Gasset's fate in Steve's eye. From then on, he always thought of the Frenchman as a backstabber. Their enmity was hardly surprising. Gasset shared some of Steve's most cagey characteristics. He was glib and charismatic and a master of hyperbole who passed himself off as a technical expert, when in fact he had no more background as a software or hardware engineer than Steve did. Like Steve, he prompted strong feelings. If there's anyone who's a prickly bastard in this world, if there's one guy who actually competes in the prickly bastard game quite effectively, says one industry veteran who worked with both men, it's the guy who learned at the hand of the master. They had other similarities. Shortly after quitting Apple, Gasset started his own computer company in a huff, bringing along several key Apple employees. His business strategy was reminiscent of Steve's approach at Next. B Incorporated set out to design an entirely new software and hardware architecture for a computer Gasset called the B-Box, which would incorporate an operating system, BOS, that shared some key attributes of Unix. What made the BOS and the B-Box computer unique, however, was that they were designed to also be able to use the existing Macintosh OS, and thus operate like a Mac clone. The intent, essentially, was to build a computer that could be two machines in one. Much like Next, however, B hadn't been able to build much of a market for its hardware, selling only 2,000 machines before shutting down that part of its business in 1996 to focus on selling its software as an alternative operating system for Apple's Macs and clones built by other manufacturers. Gasset felt that becoming a software-only company would position B to other hardware manufacturers as a potentially attractive acquisition. There seemed to be several potential suitors out there among the seven companies that made Macintosh clones, including Motorola and Powerhouse Systems, which employed Steve's former head of hardware engineering at Next, John Rubinstein. When Gasset learned that Emilio had decided to go shopping for an operating system, he was shocked. It was almost as if the stars had aligned for him to sell his company to Apple, even though he would have to deal with some new faces at the company. "I was looking for an exit sign," Gasset recalls. And here came Emilio. But Gasset made a serious tactical mistake by trying to milk the situation for all it was worth. Emilio offered to buy B Inc. for about $100 million, which was a reasonable price for a company with its limited track record. But Gasset overreached, rebuffing Emilio's offer, as well as a counteroffer of $120 million. I ran into Gasset one weeknight in late October 1996 at what was an unlikely haunt for him, the Buffalo Grill, a steakhouse, since closed, in a shopping mall in San Mateo, 15 miles north of his hometown of Palo Alto. The location was out of the way, and not the kind of place where you would go to ogle Silicon Valley notables. That was precisely why Gassay had chosen the restaurant. My wife was with me, so I nudged her on toward our table, while I hung back to say hello to Jean-Louis, whom I knew socially as well as professionally. Our daughters were classmates at a school in Palo Alto. He was clearly embroiled in serious conversation. He hadn't noticed me yet, so I slapped him on the back and asked him something like, "What are you doing up this way? Don't you have any good restaurants in Palo Alto?" Gassay recoiled as if I were a ghost. That's when I looked around the table and recognized the others. Seated with him were Ellen Hancock, a former IBMer who was now Apple's executive VP for R&D and chief technology officer, Douglas Solomon, Apple's senior VP of strategic planning and corporate development, and venture capitalist David Marquardt, who also sat on the Microsoft board of directors. Marquardt, I knew, was Bee's primary advisor for financial dealings, and his firm was also Bee's biggest investor. I realized that the very last thing this group wanted was to be seen by a business journalist. Never before had I seen the voluble Gassay at such a loss for words. When I rejoined Lorna at our table, I told her how awkward the encounter had seemed. My first reaction was that it was some sort of powwow about bringing Gassay back into Apple's management team. But if that were the case, why would Ellen Hancock, who was so new to Apple, be there instead of Gil Amelio? "Well, what do you think Steve would make of it?" Lorna asked. So when we got home, I called Steve at his home. It was a rather short conversation. When I asked Steve what he thought might be going on, he immediately shifted into petulant mode. "Jean-Louis Gassay is evil," he snapped. "I don't say that about many people, but he is evil." Then he made some comment to the effect that whatever Apple had planned, the company should have nothing to do with Gassay or his technology. "We've been at this for 10 years at Next, and the BOS is shit." "It has to be. Operating systems get better with age, and the BOS isn't old enough or tested enough to be any good." That didn't really answer my question, but it sure showed I had gotten his dander up. I asked him to be sure to let me know if he heard anything interesting. Not surprisingly, he didn't. I didn't talk to him again until December, when I called to see if I could get some comment from him for a story about Apple's surprise purchase of Next for cash and stock totaling $429 million. Steve had swung into action long before my phone call. Earlier that fall, Avi Tavanian had alerted him to the fact that Apple was looking for an operating system, and Steve immediately met with his investment bankers to determine if it made any sense to try to sell Next to Apple. We felt that we were a generation ahead of everyone else, and now we might have the chance to make that work in a mass-market world, says Tavanian. While it was public knowledge that the Next Step OS had been ported to Intel's PC microprocessors, it wasn't widely known that Avi and his team had also gotten it running on computers using the PowerPC chip. Avi and his team knew their way around all the major non-proprietary microprocessors, which is more than could be said for Bee's programmers. Steve had told Avi to drop the PowerPC effort a few months earlier. Now Avi had his team revive it and double down to make sure the OS was ready to present to Apple. Steve was playing three games at once as he approached Apple. First, he really wanted to torpedo Gassay. "Steve was bitter that I chose to side with Scully," Gassay remembers. "He said I stabbed him in the back and whatnot." One evening, as Steve was leaving the Palo Alto restaurant Il Fornaio, he passed a table of software execs that included Gassay. "So I hear you're going to save Apple, Jean-Louis," he said, before heading out the door. Gassay had no idea that Next was even being considered by Apple. He thought he had the deal sewn up. Second, Steve wanted to protect and pay back his investors. Third, He wanted to find suitable next acts for the key people who had stuck with him at Next. As Susan Barnes once told me, if you weren't good at your job, he owed it to the rest of the team to get rid of you. But if you were good, he owed you his loyalty. So, while the price was important, so was what the acquiring company intended to do with the Next technology, and how they would embrace the technologists who built it. Steve knew he had to convince Emilio that the real jewels that Apple would be acquiring were Next's people. Emilio was an easy mark, and Steve knew it. He saw him as a stuffed shirt who enjoyed the fruits of being CEO, but knew little about selling personal computers. So Steve was at his flattering best as he wooed Emilio. In a crisp presentation to the CEO and Ellen Hancock on December 2nd, he explained that he was willing to do whatever it took to make the deal work, and that he was confident that their good judgment would lead them to Next. On December 10th, he and Avi made what Emilio himself described as a dazzling presentation of the Next operating system during a bake-off against B at the Garden Court Hotel in Palo Alto. Just 10 days later, Steve had a deal, one that was sealed in Steve's kitchen and got him out of Next with more than he could ever have imagined. Avi was guaranteed a central role in the development of Apple's system software strategy and a spot on Emilio's senior executive staff. The price was rich, thanks largely to the recent success of WebObjects, and especially compared to what Emilio had offered Gassay. Steve and his investors would get $429 million in cash and Apple stock. It wasn't about the money, says Gassay, who concedes that he asked too much for B. It was about bringing Steve back. He had a choice between bringing Steve back or not bringing Steve back, and he made the right choice. They could do things we couldn't do. Most of the Apple shares went to Steve, who agreed to sign on as a special advisor to Emilio. The annual Mac World Trade Show in San Francisco was coming up in a few weeks, so he offered to make one of his trademark stage presentations after Emilio's keynote address to publicly underscore his return to the company he helped hatch. On a Saturday in late December, Steve invited me over to his house. He was already working on his remarks for Macworld, and he wanted to see what lines would resonate. But he also wanted to talk about Emilio. You wouldn't believe what a bozo Emilio is, he hissed. What most galled him was that Emilio, he felt, had no clue about selling to walking, breathing people. All he knows is the chip business, where you can count your customers on one hand, Steve groused. They aren't people. They're companies, and they buy chips by the tens of thousands. I reminded Steve that just a few months earlier he had told me about how he and Larry Ellison had briefly mulled the possibility of a hostile takeover of Apple. If he's such a bozo, why are you sticking around? Couldn't you take your share of the money and just walk? I can't just walk away from Avi and the others and say, so long, nice knowing you. Plus, he continued, I can tell that there are still a lot of other really good people at Apple. I just don't think Emilio is the right guy to lead them. Well, then, what about you? I said, asking the question on everyone's mind. Steve hemmed and hawed. He seemed as unsure of himself as I'd ever seen him. There are some people who have always believed that Steve did everything he could to engineer a triumphant return to the top job at Apple, that he was executing some grand master plan all along. Gil Emilio is one of them. Bill Gates is another. The truth is more subtle. Over the previous decade, Steve had learned to act less impulsively. In the past, he had overreached, time and again. Now he was willing to walk slowly down a path, and if following his nose led him somewhere better than where he thought he was headed, that's where he would go. In the months after the sale of Next, as he studied Emilio and understood more about the current state of Apple, Steve displayed the more deliberate approach he would bring to the company when he was in charge. The two men whom Steve trusted the most at Apple during the period following the sale of Next agree that Steve did not intend to become Apple's CEO. Avi Tavanian was now Emilio's chief of software engineering, while John Ruby Rubinstein had been brought in at Steve's suggestion to run the hardware division. "We didn't think we were coming to Apple to work for Steve," says Tavanian. "He just didn't seem that interested." Steve repeatedly told him he was reluctant to take on the job, much less lobby for it. Coming to Apple wasn't exactly a dream come true for either Avi or Ruby. A few weeks after the Next deal closed, and the two were settling into their new roles, Apple revealed that it had lost $120 million during the quarter ending December 31, 1996. "I asked Steve, 'What have we gotten ourselves into here?'" remembers Tavanian. "Because it was clear that Apple was the company that was broken, not Next. You could look at the two of us as Steve wanting to get his own people in, but he did it because it was the right thing. He knew these other people. They were the reason Apple was screwed up." "I don't believe any of the Machiavellian stuff," adds Ruby, a native New Yorker with the svelte looks of a long-distance runner. "When I got there, I took a look around and thought, 'Oh my God, what did I just get myself into?'" In the weeks after our December chat, Steve and I met a few more times over his kitchen table for a series of off-the-record discussions. Steve described what he was finding at Apple, in the hope that I would push ahead with a story about the sorry state of things in Cupertino. He spoke freely, although he insisted that I disguise any quotes I wanted to use. At one point, he rhetorically asked, "Why do I feel like it's my fiduciary responsibility to see a negative story about my own company?" The main answer was that the more he got to know Emilio, the more he realized that Dr. Gill and his team could never lead Apple back to any kind of prominence. He was dismayed by so much at the company, and he blamed the board of directors as much as Emilio. He couldn't believe that any board could ever have envisioned the dour Michael Spindler, the diesel, as an inspirational leader, just as he was dumbfounded that the board had then hired someone like Emilio. He believed that Emilio, who ascended to the CEO position after just 1 year on the board, had maneuvered himself into the gig by positioning himself as a turnaround expert. "But how can he be a turnaround expert?" Steve asked me. "When he eats his lunch alone in his office, with food served to him on china that looks like it came from Versailles." Emilio did himself no favors. Rather than adapt to Apple, he seemed to try to get the company to take on his personality. He had surrounded himself with top executives, drawn mostly from the semiconductor industry he knew so well, and he was never effective in public situations. Once, while talking to a group at a dinner party that included Larry Ellison, Emilio tried to put his company's problems in perspective for the other guests. "Apple is a boat," he said. "There's a hole in the boat, and it's taking on water. But there's also a treasure on board, and the problem is, everyone on board is rowing in different directions, so the boat is just standing still. My job is to get everyone rowing in the same direction." After Emilio walked away, Ellison turned to the person standing next to him and asked, "But what about the hole?" That was one story Steve never got tired of telling. Steve was unfair to Emilio. Although he did once tell Emilio that arranging the $661 million in new financing was a good move, he gave him little credit for anything else. Even though it was Emilio who signed off on the critical restructuring that Anderson was managing. And when Steve did acknowledge that there was some good work going on inside the company, he credited this to employees who had the true Apple spirit, the one that he and Woz had instilled years before, and not at all to Emilio. But Steve was also right about Emilio, as I discovered when I did finally report and write a story about Apple for Fortune in early 1997. In dire need of strong leadership, Apple was in the hands of a bumbling CEO. It had almost 24 separate marketing teams, which didn't communicate with one another. Its product line was metastasizing. The Mac clone licensing program made no sense, and Emilio was letting the problems get out of hand. His lack of leadership went on public display at the annual Macworld trade show in San Francisco on January 7, 1987. Emilio's opening